From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
There's like a growing segment of research that seeks to examine how the legacy of slavery continues to shape social outcomes in the American South. We wanted to try to speak to that work a little bit and examine a part of it that hadn't been looked at before up until that point, which is school segregation in the South, which has a long and troubled history in this region, especially as we show in the paper, related to places where slavery was a major part of the economy.
Robert L. Reese, a PhD candidate in the Sociology Department at Duke University, and co-author How the Legacy of Slavery and Racial Composition Shaped Public School Enrollment in the American South. Slavery was abolished more than 150 years ago, but its effects are still felt today in K-12 education in the South, according to a new Rice University study. The study found that African-American population concentration relationship only holds in the original Confederate states or the Deep South, Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, and Texas. Using regression analysis to explain differences in the degree of attendance disparities across most counties in the South, researchers found a correlation between historically geographic slave concentration and modern K-12 segregation. An increase in slave concentration is related to greater underrepresentation of white students in public schools. The results suggest that the legacy of slavery contributes to black-white education disparities through greater public-private school racial segregation. I'm Johnny L. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, How the Legacy of Slavery and Racial Composition Shaped Public School Enrollment in the American South, with co-author Robert L. Reese and Heather O'Connell in Black America.
That is a real struggle of this field of study in general, I think. Mm-hmm. It's hard to wrap your head around it, right? That 150 years ago something happened and today it still matters. But I think, Robert, I think that you're going to be able to talk about this a little bit more based on your dissertation research. But I think what's important to remember is that there are a lot of things that are happening during that time that are also partially a legacy of slavery. It's not as if once it were abolished that it were completely gone. Mm-hmm. So things were still happening in that interim period, and it's possible that in places where slavery was most entrenched or places that were most dependent on that slave labor, that things continued after the fact to help reinforce those foundational ideas that were what slavery was all about or what it was based on.
Heather O'Connell, a postdoctoral fellow at Rice University Kendall Institute for Urban Research. The legacy of slavery still impacts education in the South. Slavery was abolished more than 150 years ago, but its effects are still felt today in K-12 education in the South, according to a new Rice University study. The study found that African-American population concentration relationship only holds in the original Confederate states or the Deep South, Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, and Texas. Even with the added dimensions, the researchers were unable to identify tangible county characteristics that explain why slave concentration from 1860 is related to contemporary school enrollment patterns. Understanding the role of slavery provides insight into the structural foundation supporting this segregation, which might be valuable to efforts to reverse dangerous trends, and school resegregation has been increasing across the South over the last few decades. Recently in Black America spoke with co-author Heather O'Connell, a postdoctoral fellow at Rice University's Kendall Institute for Urban Research, and Robert L. Reese, a PhD candidate at Duke University.
The core of the data is coming from the census. It's all secondary data sources, and it's for the counties among the southern states. And the tricky part about the data is connecting that historical data that's telling us what the concentration of slaves looked like in 1860. Because counties in 1860, what the data are reported for is what counties were in 1860, and that doesn't match up with what we see today. So we had to do some finagling to try to match up those spaces But that was really the only tricky part. And once you have all of this information together, then we did what's called a regression analysis, which is just a fancy way of saying that we compared places that are very similar to each other. And while controlling for other factors, the regression analysis will tell you how closely related particular variables are to your outcome. So in our case, we were most interested in how closely related is the historical concentration of slaves to the current level of segregation between public and private schools for black and white students.
When you look at the segregation of students, was it more so economically, or was it, I guess, class as the division of how African-American students were educated?
That's a good question. Robert, do you want to?
Yeah, well, we included some measures of socioeconomic status. So mm-hmm. we included a measure of income and a measure of poverty and a measure of education of the entire county. And we also included some measures for school quality. And it seemed that despite all of those things, that slavery and the percentage of black students in the schools and in the counties were the strongest factors driving this white disinvestment from the public school system to enroll in private schools, which was driving, one of the forces driving segregation in these areas.
Yeah, so we didn't look specifically at where the segregation is coming from,
mm-hmm.
but as Robert was saying, that since we're controlling for these other factors that would be related to economic differences, what we're showing is that these relationships are independent of economic segregation or any segregation that we might think was related to economic circumstances. And there's been some recent research that shows that black-white segregation is much less about, there's more black-white segregation than left over after you account for segregation that's based on economic factors.
When you were conducting the study, was the information in which you ascertained dealt with enrollment in public and private schools from both spectrums, from both ends, African-American student versus white students?
Well, we looked at it a variety of ways while we were working things out, but we decided to go with to look at racial disparities in enrollment in public school
mm-hmm.
under the assumption that there's only two types of schools that you can be involved. Broadly, there's only two types of schools you can be enrolled in, public schools and private schools.
Right.
And if black students are more likely to enroll in public schools, that means the white students, by extension, must be more likely to enroll in the private schools.
When you look at geographically slave concentration, I'm trying to wrap around the concept. If slavery was abolished, say, 150 years ago, and we're still seeing these lingering vestiges, what has happened during that period in your analysis?
That is a real struggle of this field of study in general, I think.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's hard to wrap your head around it, right? That 150 years ago something happened, and today it still matters. But I think, and Robert, I think that you're going to be able to talk about this a little bit more based on your dissertation research. But I think what's important to remember is that there are a lot of things that are happening during that time that are also partially a legacy of slavery. It's not as if once it were abolished that it were completely gone.
Mm-hmm.
So things were still happening in that interim period, and it's possible that in places where slavery was most entrenched or places that were most dependent on that slave labor, that things continued after the fact to help reinforce those foundational ideas that were what slavery was all about or what it was based on. Robert, did you want to add to that?
Right. It's just that slavery, the institution of slavery, forced counties to erect certain types of systems, certain types of institutions, to try to maintain the economy that they used during antebellum slavery. In our case, We argue that school segregation was fundamental to maintaining the economy in places where slavery was strongest. For example, in places with that relied on a plantation economy, likely cotton in the Deep South. They didn't want to educate black people, black workers. They didn't want them to have the opportunity to get better jobs, to leave the plantation. So school segregation, giving these black people inferior schools was fundamental to maintaining the economy in these areas. And that legacy continued on through the decades when school integration, when Canadians were forced to integrate in the 60s and 70s, these private schools cropped up, and which allowed white students ways to avoid school integration because it had become a part of the way of life of these areas.
When you look at the Confederate states, Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, and Texas, and you look at the educational attainment of these African-American populations, how is that legacy of slavery affecting, one, dropout rates and those who continue their education through 12th grade? Obviously, there must be some lingering effects that those who are interested in education or really feel that education is essential for upward mobility. Was that part of the narrative?
I think that's part of the background motivation.
Okay.
I think, at least based on other work, racial segregation is very important for understanding subsequent achievement,
okay,
particularly for black students, I think. And so that does, if it happens that segregation also helps isolate black students and potentially have access to lower quality education, then yes, if you're in a school that it seems like the educational system doesn't really care about you, then any student is going to be more likely to drop out and to do less well in school. So that is sort of a second step consequence of what we're studying, but our study doesn't speak directly to what the legacy of slavery consequences are for educational achievement and attainment.
When you look at the system in itself, obviously segregation still exists, but I'm trying to wrap my brain around, you're still in 2015 have individuals that are first generation college graduates. When you're looking at slavery being abolished, like I say, 150 years ago. So in these particular counties, are the counties themselves still maintaining the status quo, or they're still trying to get up from under what transpired during slavery?
That's what we argue. We argue that that slavery actually alters the characteristics of the places, that it alters the county.
Okay.
So that it's not necessarily the people per se. So we aren't asking the question whether I, as a descendant of slaves, is more or less likely to go to a private school. The question is whether black people who live in this place are more or less likely to go to a private school. And it's so we argue that it is about the places, that it's about institutions such as like just the availability of private schools, right? Like what types of places even have private schools with this strong racial legacy. It's about the way of life of these places has been cultivated over the last century and a half. So it's actually, yes, we're talking about places and what places do and how they facilitate the actions of people.
Now, when you look at these counties, are these small counties that are not associated or connected to large metropolitan areas? I'm asking, are these rural areas that we're speaking of that had a large concentration of African Americans?
So we're in the paper, we're looking at all of the counties all at one time.
Mm-hmm.
But we are controlling for whether or not it's it contains a large metropolitan area.
Okay.
So basically what that ends up meaning is that this argument about the legacy of slavery applies even within metropolitan counties.
Okay. Okay.
So even if it does have a large urban center today, then it is just as true that among those types of counties that a higher concentration of slaves is related to a higher level of segregation than we would have otherwise expected.
In any particular reason why this type of study hasn't taken place prior to you all's endeavor? People were just lazy or they didn't think it was important.
I think
Robert.
Robert, go ahead.
It may be, well, the field is relatively new.
Okay.
So before this one, there are probably less than around 10 or so studies that do something really close to this. And that may be, I think it's for a variety of reasons. One is, like Heather said earlier, it's difficult to work with historical data because the geographic units change over time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that may be one of the larger barriers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so folks have started picking up on this topic a good bit more. Yeah. And partly because the historical data are now more easily available. Once one person does it, then we can just all share with each other.
Right.
How prevalent was white flight a part of you all's narrative when you look at the totality of the study?
I think, if I'll just jump in, I think the idea about white flight and just is that there's a general avoidance of black populations. So
mm-hmm.
this is more a specific part of our analysis when we're talking about the relationship between black population concentration and school segregation. But it's also, so that's the more traditional way to think about white flight, but white flight is also happening more generally. You can't really talk about how the legacy of slavery is affecting school segregation without also thinking that there might be white flight processes involved, and so that it's just that it might be that it just happens at a lower level of black concentration. White flight is just, it's more sensitive to the number of black folks who are in a school or who are in the area, that sort of thing. So it was a big part of our story, but it's a really difficult topic to sort of pin down in a quantitative analysis, I think.
Right.
If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio, and we're speaking with Dr. Heather O'Connell, postdoctoral fellow at Rice University Kinder Institute for Urban Research, and Robert L. Reese, PhD candidate at Duke University in the Department of Sociology. They are co-authors of the study, Legacy of Slavery Still Impacts Education in the South. Heaven forbid that these counties are still operating under a false sense of honesty, but the question I have is that are some of these counties still with the mindset that African-American children don't need to be educated?
Well, we can't measure that directly, but...
Well, given the sufficient resources for a quality education, I guess that would be the caveat to that question.
And... So other studies have shown that that people don't necessarily believe that per se, as much as there's still an ongoing stigma against attending schools with black students, and that's
mm-hmm.
and other studies on education and school segregation show that consistently that. White parents have an aversion to sending their children to schools where there were going to be a lot of black students.
Dr. O'Connell, any comment?
No, that pretty much gets at it. It is really difficult to say what it is that these places, the school districts within the counties or the counties themselves believe about the education. That would just be a a whole different approach than what we took, something that might be beneficial, but not something that we can speak to at this time. And I think, yeah, it is important to remember that it's not, we do live in a different time, even mm-hmm. though we are still influenced by our history.
Right.
There are a lot of conversations in sociology about how the way that Americans present things mm-hmm. is different. And so as Robert was saying, Americans don't say directly that Black students don't do well or don't deserve this, but just that my white student does deserve this and does do this well. So it's just more of a protection of self rather than an explicit disadvantaging of other.
Doing your survey and analysis, when you looked at the counties, were there any information ascertained as far as the number of African American students who are education eligible, I guess that will be the term, those that were eligible for education, those that actually took part in the educational process, those that dropped out, and those that graduated K through 12. Was that part of the study?
No, we didn't look at that. We only examined the students who were actually in school at the time and whether or not, what type of school they attended, whether or not they attended a public school or a private school.
And looking at those numbers, were the students in school relative to the numbers of the children that were in that county?
Yes. So the number is, so we use only the students who were in school. The number of children in the county ultimately didn't matter. For one, like, most children are in school.
Okay.
Like, the overwhelming majority of children are generally in school. But only the children that were in school actually mattered for our analysis. We didn't look at the number of students who made, the number of school-aged children who may not be in school.
When, I guess, I don't know if I asked this question, but when you looked at the schools, were the schools in which African Americans attended versus the schools that the majority white students attended, were they on par or separate and unequal? I guess that's the question.
So since we were focusing specifically on the counties, mm-hmm. we don't have the specifics on the schools, or we at least didn't keep that in the analysis. But I think Robert mentioned earlier that we do control for, at one point in the models, we controlled for the quality of schools in the county. So that's more of an overall measure. It's not the black students are attending this quality level of schools and mm-hmm. white students are attending this level of quality. We didn't look at that specifically, but just wanted to know whether or not this sort of public-private school segregation persisted even in places where the quality of public schools was overall very good. And we found that to be the case, that the quality of public schools didn't matter for the extent of racial separation between public and private schools. And it also didn't matter whether or not private school quality was greater than public school quality, or to the extent that that was true, because that's not always the case. Public and private schools in some counties were often very similar in measurable ways.
I guess the next question is, how will this information, if at all, assist Arne Duncan in his analysis of our educational system in this country? Robert?
Well, we hope to show that we hope to show policymakers that that history matters, and we can't really understand how to institute proper policy interventions to curb the tide of school segregation and to improve the educational outcomes of Black students unless we understand how history is shaping these outcomes. Like, history informs how and why these things are the way they are. And if we refuse to look historically, then we miss a part of the story. And if we're missing part of the story, then we can't completely fix the problem.
When all is said and done at the end of the day, how does this information, and you somewhat articulate, affect our societal structure that facilitate white disinvestment in our public school system? Obviously, everyone needs to buy into to the same thing, I would assume.
I think, I mean, it is kind of a, it's kind of a big statement that we're trying to make in saying that history matters, and what is that actually going to change? Some of what we've been thinking about is about how this is, if we listen to the discourse when we're talking about school segregation or just schools in general, I think it's helpful to recognize that some of that discourse is coming from a historical foundation, okay, so that we can use that information when we're having these conversations and say, and really call each other out to say, well, where is that idea coming from? Why is it that you think that that's the way that this should be done? And are there other ways that we can think about this that could be more productive? And I think also just to recognize that if this is something that's really influencing school segregation in the United States, then this goes pretty deep. If it's something that's infused into your day-to-day life, then that's going to be sort of a sticky and personal issue. And so that these are going to be some tough conversations. And I think that we know that, but that we just need to get prepared for that. And that we'll have to really stand by any policy decisions that we make, because short-term things are not really where this is going to, if that's not where this is at, that's not going to fix very much for us.
Looking down the road, hopefully, what type of discussion do you want educators and I guess parents and civic leaders to look at?
Like Heather was just saying, we want people to understand how deep the roots of school segregation, particularly this type of dual school system that's developed in the American South, goes. That is not something you can fix with a Band-Aid, the Band-Aid policy solution. It's not something that's recent. It's not a recent development. Like, this goes down. It goes back to the very beginnings of the establishment of the universal education system in the American South in the late 19th century. So it's not, we want people to have like these deep historical discussions about the foundations of these processes and try to develop solutions with that knowledge in mind.
Robert L. Reese, a PhD candidate at Duke University, and Heather O'Connell, a postdoctoral fellow at Rice University's Kendall Institute for Urban Research. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at jhanson@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Remember to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.